tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey guys, welcome to the Chitza Sherber Experience on Full Service Radio. We are live from the Line Hotel. I am your host, Violeta Edelman, and I'm here with my co-host and partner in crime,
Rob Duncan.
We're gelato makers. We own Dolcezza Gelato in Washington, D.C. We have 10 locations, and we make small batch gelato every day in our factory in Northeast D.C. since 2004. Our guest today is Josh Coggan. Josh is an Emmy Award-winning photographer and anthropologist. Josh specializes in telling stories of culture and transitions. His work has taken him to 40 countries and 5 continents, and has also appeared in The New Yorker, GQ, Washington Post, National Geographic, and The New York Times. So welcome, Josh. Thanks so much for being with us today.
And he's a really good friend. It goes way back, first and foremost, right? That's all the accolades that he has, but yeah. He's a brother from another.
He's a brother from another. Thank you for being here, brother from another.
Yo.
Thank you for having me.
So I always start by giving our listeners a little bit of background. So I'm going to ask the obvious question, which is how you started with photography. How did you get started? And tell us about, you know, there's a little bit of an obsession with National Geographic, and I used to work there. Yeah. I don't know if we met there, but I feel like maybe we did. So tell us a story.
So photography started for me when I was studying abroad in Israel. Actually, I was living in Jerusalem, and I think I'd always kind of seen people doing photography. It never really, like, it was something that excited me, but I never really had access to it. And when I was living in Jerusalem, obviously you're kind of living in a picture. It's a really beautiful experience. And something told me to go pick up a camera. So I went to a shop. I found kind of a cheap used one I could downtown. I was actually like working in downtown Jerusalem as a waiter at the same time. And picked up this camera, and there was just this very immediate resonance. And I think mostly I explained it. I was probably less so, but fairly ADHD. And something about the photography really kind of crystallized the ability to kind of stay with one topic or kind of narrow the field of vision a little bit, you know, quite literally, but also in terms of my ability to kind of like find flow or that white noise space. Came back from Israel, just kept shooting and shooting and shooting. You know, it became an obsession, as anything does, that you have a kind of a relationship with that is in art or creativity. You know, your heart kind of gives to it, it gives back to you. It's this kind of like iterative process. You know, I never really thought about making a living out of it at first, and then I kind of graduated my degree in anthropology. I think.
How old were you there in Jerusalem?
I was 21, and I'm actually, it's good you brought me back to that, because I think the other thing about the camera was it gave me this excuse. This was between the two intifadas in Jerusalem, so it was a fairly peaceful time, given kind of Israel's kind of current situation in modern history. And so it was this excuse to go to the Arab quarters and to the territories and to Bethlehem and Jericho and all these different places. And there was something about having the camera that was an excuse to be with people.
It's like me with the we were just talking about it outside, a baby.
Yeah,
the fact that I could walk behind all the buildings and the alleyways with a baby strapped to me, mm-hmm. allowed me access that I could, so mm-hmm. you kind of like hid behind the camera,
yeah.
as an access, so you weren't like suspicious or something like that.
Yeah, there's something, people will give you a little carte blanche. I think also when you're meeting things with curiosity, there's an excuse there, right?
It's funny, because for me it was always the opposite. I took a couple of photography classes, and I always felt intimidated, and I always felt like I was imposing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like a door that was opening. It was more like, oh, here I am with my camera, and mm-hmm. I'm supposed to point it at you. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel comfortable for me.
And I think for a lot of people it is like that. You know, I've heard people always ask me, how do you do that? How do you just point your camera at someone? But for me, I think maybe there is this process as I truly, like I say, I fall in love with people when I'm photographing them. I really, really, like, I see them and I adore them. And I think that energy comes across. And so maybe that's also a barrier drop.
Could in that, like, I've heard photographers talk about, like, the goal is to where the camera disappears. So it's like kind of like the subject, mm-hmm. because of the way the photographer does it or something, they kind of don't, they don't see the camera there. And that's what I probably ultimately want, that they're in their element, and that's what you kind of capture.
It's true. And, you know, I think as I've gotten later in my career, actually, the camera has gotten more in the way. I find myself just doing actually more audio and storytelling that way, just because being in the process with them, you know, actually just being in the moment. But I stick with photography because it's it's paid the bills thus far.
That's a factor, too.
And I guess to skip forward, I came back, you know, kind of graduated from college, wandered around for a few years, was traveling. Another thing that Jerusalem gave me was a real love of travel. I went to Turkey and Greece and Sinai and kind of all these areas. So that's where I really got bit by wanderlust. And I graduated from college with this deep fear that life would never be that good. I actually really remember thinking like I had peaked at 21. Like Jerusalem was the peak of experience and I was going to go back and
work a 9-to-5 in a desk
and live in the suburbs.
Bitter.
Well, that is the American dream, right?
Yeah. And I don't give anyone proper doing that, but for me, it didn't feel right, you know? And so I kind of traveled around for a couple of years, and I think I was actually living in St. Croix. I was working in a dive shop in St. Croix. I'd gone to live in Colorado for a while, ski bummed for a while, I dive bummed for a while. I kind of did the kind of like place-based living thing for a while and was like, well, I got to do something with my degree.
That's,
you know,
so funny. It's like St. Croix now to me is like sparkling water. So it's like, you wouldn't
that's
live where
La Croix.
That. Ah, you're right. La Croix. La Croix. La St. Croix. Yeah, you're right.
It sounds similar, so, but yeah.
Yeah, it's all colored cans. And yeah. Not beautiful islands. And
so I like came back, and I think there was a guy down there that knew somebody. I don't know if you ever knew Tom Craig, but he ran the photo lab at National Geographic, and somebody knew him down
okay.
there.
I remember going to the photo lab, but no, I don't remember him in particular. I was in the TV building.
And that was it. I had a singular focus because I didn't actually see myself living as a photographer, like just working at Geographic because I wanted to do anthropology. You know, that was my background, was in anthropology. I loved people. I loved kind of curiosity and exploring, and it seemed like, so I didn't think about making a living as a photographer. I never had training other than my self-training. And then I knew this one guy that was a manager at the photo lab. And literally, I just kept showing up, and they're like, well, I kept trying to get jobs there, actually, at Geographic, doing illustrations coordinator or doing photo coordinator. I could never get any of these
jobs. Is that what brought you to D.C.?
Yeah.
To come to work with Geographic?
A combination of that and being by my dad, who had remarried later in life, had younger kids.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to be by my little brother and little sister as they grew up, or I felt like I wouldn't be around. They were 15 to 18 years younger than me.
Right.
So there was a certain kind of like feeling of familial responsibility, and came back and, you know, was trying to get all these jobs. I couldn't get a job to save my life. Finally, they had a customer service job at the photo lab, which was really pretty straightforward. You didn't even really need special training. It was just kind of front of the desk and taking orders and fulfilling them. And I went and applied, and they said, you're overqualified. We can't hire you. And I was like, what is this with this place? And then I went home, and I talked to my grandmother. Actually, I called my bubby. That's what we're calling.
Bubby.
And she was like, well, what about telling them you'll work for free? Like, nobody can turn down free work. And I was like, that's strangely brilliant. So I went the next day and offered to work for free. And that's how I got into Geographic. So I never worked there. I was just a volunteer. And I got free film and free processing because I used to give away the old film from the photo lab. That's how I met AJ, which is actually how I met you guys.
Ah, okay.
Oh, wow.
So AJ is somebody who pops up in like 90% of our shows.
No, so fun. Yeah, there is like, he's present. I mean, that's why it's like AJ's weirdly like
connected
to every single person, that we've brought in here almost.
One day we need to bring AJ.
He's a Buddha waiting to ascend.
Oh, he is, man. This fuzzy little Buddha.
Yeah, totally.
Well, AJ.
So you're working at, you're volunteering at Geographic. You're still like an unknown anthropologist / photographer. And then what happens?
I'm the annoying kid that comes upstairs and keeps trying to talk to the photo editors who like want like, nothing to do with me. Uh-huh. You know, I'm shooting, showing people work. They're like, yeah, it's just not that good. You know, I mean, quite honestly, you know. I was falling in love with DC because I was shooting a lot at the Drum Circle, which has always been a sweet home for me, and other places, and meeting people. You know, it's a very small town in its own way. And went back to grad school to do a graduate degree in ethnobotany, which is another one of areas of our like
connection.
And I really loved graduate school, but my professor was an amazing woman, Dr. Fatima Jackson, and she was treated very poorly by the staff, for a number of reasons, but there was a lot of prejudice involved. And I started seeing all the politics that existed in academics, and so I just really, I thought, well, maybe this is, I'll go get my PhD in this, and then I was like, no, but there's all this politics here, I don't want to be a part of this. In arts, there's no politics, I'll go to that. Well, I was very wrong in that choice.
Everywhere you go.
But, so, what I started doing at a certain point, I was at Geographic, and you must have known Mick Davies. Or known his name.
Maybe.
So he was this like kind of young ingenue storyteller at the time. He still is. He's a fantastic filmmaker, but he was this 25-year-old kid, and he had multiple awards, and he was like the wonder kid of Geographic. And he was there, and I was like in the cafeteria at Geographic one day, and I was like, I don't know, Mick. Like, I don't know how to make it. And he's like, listen, you can sit around here and wait for somebody to find you, or you can go do something, which was a very good another fundamental piece of advice. And he... at that time, it was just kind of the excuse I needed to do. So I decided to go do this project in the last years of southern India. There's a very small town called Cochin. And my bubby, same lady who had actually given me a bit of that wanderlust, because she had traveled a lot, had been in southern India and had told me about this really old Jewish community, kind of really turned on my idea to going there. And so that's what got me the plane ticket, got me to India, and probably was the entry point. I went there for 2 months, had my camera stolen in the first week of me being there. Almost came home. My dad said, I knew this would happen to you. My mom said, stay there. I'll figure out how to get you a camera. You know, I'd spent every last dime I had on this camera. I was bartending around the corner at Madam's Organ at the time. You know, that's how I was making a living. And so another camera, after sitting around for a while, a camera comes and I just start shooting. Something about actually also being in India without a camera, like it was like a slingshot, you know, it was like all of a sudden, like I'm just looking, not shooting. They say they do that in a lot of photo trainings. Don't always go photograph.
Oh, that's interesting.
And just looking
it's
every
kinda
day.
It's kind of like the drumming in Africa.
Yeah.
Your first 6 months, you don't even pick up a drum. You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of learning the language.
So the camera gets there, and I just start shooting. And I come back with a story. And I remember I went back to Elizabeth Christ, who was a photo editor at Geographic, and probably the 10th time I'd taken her work. And at this point, she's probably so over me. And she starts looking at the work. And this was still in the day of slides. And she kind of like just starts buttering through the images as she always does. And then she stops on the fourth one and goes back to the first one. It was like, hold on, there's something here. Then sent me to Susan Smith, who was the director of photography at the time at Geographic. Susan Smith called me up to her office and she said, I thought you were just this annoying little anthropologist kid. It turns out you're pretty good. And that was all it ever really took, actually. You know, Geographic never ended up being like a big venue for me, but something about an external confirmation of, all right, there's something here, gave me enough courage to continue and find my own way.
And I remember those photos from India because you took them to our first store that we opened in Georgetown in 2004, and mm-hmm. we did a photo exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
We hung them on the walls. And
what was it in Georgetown, or was it in DuPont?
No, it was in Georgetown. It was the first shop.
Yeah. Because your mom was there.
My mom was there, and you show up with your photos, and you were all transformed by your Indian trip, and you exuded, you know, that whole vibe.
I remember those initial days, like when we first were like getting to know Josh and first meeting him with the trips of India and all the discussions of the like psychedelics down in the in South America, Central America, and all that. Yeah, I remember that very well.
So, Josh, the focus of a lot of your work is quote unquote the other. And basically shining light on traditional cultures that are in threat of extinction by globalization. So you're trying to preserve them by sharing their knowledge with the world. And you have some incredible stories about these cultures that you've been to and you met. One of the first one being the tribe in the jungle of Panama. That was back when you were doing your senior thesis, right, in ethnobotany. Was that the first time that you felt like you were immersed in a culture that was not... affected so much by globalization, and how was that experience?
I think that was, that was probably, I mean, India had a lot of that. I think India started showing up that spirit was everywhere. right? In India, that was one of the really powerful things, and that's one of the other threads I like pull on a lot of my work, is the power of spirit and faith, which is something that is kind of the antithesis of globalism in a lot of ways.
What is the spirit? The spirit of the culture, the knowledge that is passed through generations?
Spirit as in faith, as in worship, as in, I think the moment it really came through to me, actually, and this was probably something that showed up in Israel too, but a little more so in India, is like I was sitting around one day just shooting on the street, and this guy just kind of pulled up on a moped and he wrapped these garlands around a telephone post and then stuck a piece of incense in them and lit it. And I was just like, everybody's just like blessing everything around here all the time. That they're existing in a different framework that's not just always about commerce and
transactions,
trade.
Transactions, right.
Yeah. And so I think that did a lot for me. And then, you know, as I started spending more time with indigenous communities, which was down when I was living in Panama with the Kuna, where it was a deep immersion there, and you could see that first layer of globalism coming in. The Kuna were very famous for actually having resisted all forms of colonialism. The Spanish couldn't conquer them. When they came down through the canal, they couldn't conquer them. But what happened is all these Colombian traders, it's an archipelago on the east side of Panama, all these traders were coming up from South America, and they were starting to sell them things they traditionally didn't use. And so all these other things, you know, the most powerful, like, empirical forces in the world that could have no effect on these people.
The iPhone did it.
Exactly.
Shiny objects. Yeah.
And so that was the point. And then I've just seen that story played out a million ways and in a million layers, because it still happens here in our own community, in our own cities. Gentrification is also a process like that.
So tell me some of the stories of these people that you encounter. You talk about the India, the last magician colony in Central Delhi. So who are they, and how is their trade getting lost?
So they're an interesting example of a group. So this was on what you're speaking of, Violeta, is a group called the Kathputli. The area is called the Kathputli Colony, and it was considered, and it is, a magician's colony. At the time of speaking, it's no longer there, I can tell you, which is kind of one of the sad things. But around 2011, we decided to do a story. I got reached out by a friend of mine named Jim Goldblum, and he kind of said, hey, there's this whole magician's colony in New Delhi. I want to do a film. I know you mostly have done photo to this point, but this colony is about to get developed. I read about it in a paragraph in Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. And so I researched, and it turns out this place actually does exist. And what these were the gypsies that didn't leave India, or what they are called, you know, sometimes colloquially as gypsies. And the gypsy culture, the Roma culture, came out of Rajasthan in India, and then it floated down the Silk Road into Europe and spread actually all over. But this is the group that didn't leave. They actually floated around in the country. So you probably know some of the old famous Steve McCurry photos of the girl walking on the tightrope or the fire breathers. Well, what had happened around the 1960s, when India came on the world stage, there was this desire to export their culture globally, right? And these were like a very kind of like easy way to do it, right? Fire breathers and snake charmers and magicians, and like the story of the people that could make the rope climb out of the jar and then they'd climb up the rope. These were those guys. And because they were getting flown out of the country so much, you know, they had historically just been itinerants wandering around the country. And this is actually where things like yoga came from. The acrobats went and spread yogic systems throughout the country, right? So they'd pick up these cool little things and they'd travel them around. And because they had become kind of so notable on the world stage, they decided, well, we're just going to stay in Delhi. There's more money if we hang out here, and then we go fly and meet heads of state and this and that. And at that time, Delhi wasn't a very big city. There were a couple million people. They settled in a jungle on the west side of the city. At the time of the telling of the story in 2011, Delhi had become 220 million people. And so this land that they had squatted on had become extremely valuable. A metro stop had been put outside, right, which like raises real estate prices significantly. And developers wanted to take over the land, right?
220 million people in the city.
I believe that number is right.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah.
Three quarters of what we have here in this whole country.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they have 1.3 billion in India right now.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we kind of went there, and we went to go tell the story, and we showed up, and like, you know, don't be fooled. This was probably one of the most difficult stories I ever had to tell, because by nature, these are magicians, right? And it's not magicians like we think, like pulling a rabbit out of a hat and these type of things. Like, their act is to scare the living hell out of you and make you believe that they have supernatural powers.
True magician, right?
So they will give you will give them money as the audience. That means making them think somebody is going to die, cutting out somebody's tongue, and they'll speak to you in whatever your cultural kind of norms are. If it's a Hindu crowd, he will invoke Hindu gods. If it's Muslim gods, you know, there were equal opportunity there. And there were a couple of times where, like, the characters we'd be doing stories on, you know, there was one, Rahman, who is the main magician that we were focusing on. One day, he had these, like, kind of cuts on his arm, and he actually had his pinky cut off. And he said, guys, you know, listen, like, my mom, she was in the hospital last month. She got really sick. I had to take out this money from a loan shark, and I really need to pay him back, or, like, bad things are going to happen. And he starts showing us these cuts on his arm and this and that. And we're, like, looking at this thing, and we're like, oh, man, we got to get, like, Rahman out of debt. Like, he's going to lose more fingers, you know? And then we're kind of getting ready. He needed something like 10,000 rupees, a couple hundred dollars. And we're like, all right, well, maybe we'll go ahead and give him this money, you know? And just before we're going to do it, we're, like, sitting around one night, and I was like, he's conning us. This is a total con. And I went back to Rahman the other day. I was like, you're not telling us the truth. Your mom's not in the hospital. That's not how you go. He's like, yeah, you know.
What are you going to do?
No, we're hustling here.
And it was funny because it was like, there was no shame in it. He's like, hey, I had to try the hustle.
You shame know? Is shame is a Western quality, I think, a lot. Not so much in the East.
Yeah. And so we did the story, went back a couple of times, and like, inevitably, the colony got developed. They've now been moved to a squatter's area. And like, listen, it was nothing perfect. Like, the colony was a tough place to live. There's a lot of alcoholism. There's a lot of gambling. You take an itinerant culture, you stick them in one place, like, things can go a little sideways. There's a lot of disease. A lot of their traditional acts, they're not allowed to perform on the street anymore, right? Because the artist caste is also considered similar to the beggar's caste in India. So none of these questions about culture, you know, I think it can be very, like, kind of Western developed culture to say, you should maintain your traditional ways. But, you know, it's just like saying people, they can't use their own resources.
It's like they say that, and then in the meantime, they're marketing and trying to sell all the trinkets and technology, which is, I mean, understandably, it's hard and possible to resist something that makes your life that much easier. Mm-hmm. Like, instead of a dugout canoe with paddles in the Amazon, now you have an outboard motor on the back and you can cover the distance much easier. So I see it as I love the romantic notion of maintaining and preserving the world's cultures because of all the reasons that you talk about. I just don't see how much possibility there really is in doing it. And again, trying to stay out of the judgment of it, it is what it is. And it just seems like that, as opposed to maintaining your cultural differences and this and that, it's actually like all coming, it's like technology's all bringing it into one platform. And it's kind of, it seems like that's what's happening, much empowered by technology. So it's actually almost the opposite of what's happening now. I see. It's like we're all kind of like coming together, and those cultures and differences are kind of like disappearing. And I see it as a for better and for worse.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's
like
really,
all things.
Well, you are preserving them with your photographs.
With memory. Definitely in that way. But I mean, as far as like to the idea of maintaining the old shamans in the Amazon rainforest with no contact and all that. That's almost over down there. I mean, they're still uncontacted, but it's...
I mean, even the 10 years I've been doing this process, to think about, like, I've gone to visit some of these places, you know, even just think about the window of the magician's colony. I told that story in 2011, 2018, it's gone.
It's now like magic condos.
Yeah. And I, you know, like, again, like, I think, like, saying, oh, you have to stay as you are, it's never going to work, it's a useless conversation to have. I do think there's a real power in preservation, right? Like, And I don't mean that, but like almost like kind of the knowledge. You know, you think about traditional medicines, traditional ways, these kind of like very ephemeral layers of knowledge, especially in oral traditions. there's a responsibility. Like, we lose so much.
Of course. You lose your humanity.
No, it breaks my heart.
You lose your history. Yeah. I mean, that's who we are. Once we forget about that, who are we? Are we just consumers? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I agree. You know. And it breaks my heart. I mean, especially mostly with the Amazon rainforests, which more is like, that's mm-hmm. where like a lot of my attention's been focused on, and just that happening where you cut down forests and mm-hmm. you lose not only species of plants, mm-hmm. but you lose the actual uses, which only certain tribes in that area know. Mm-hmm. So that's future medicines and treatments. But, and it's terrible, but yeah. I just don't see it stopping.
But what you also hear there, if you look at about extinction of language versus extinction of species, like language loss is moving at the exact same speed as species loss. Like, and even the most vulnerable ones, like insects and reptiles, are something at like, we've lost 20% of species, we've lost 28% of languages. So they're actually like, biodiversity is actually linked to our own cultural diversity as well. Culture doesn't have to be the enemy of nature. It actually can be the protector. But we lose a lot of that. And then if you talk about commerce, I tell a story that I love here in D.C. So even to just say how we do this in kind of Washington, D.C., I did a story on a woman, Cara Olivia Heron, who is actually here and has her own radio show in Tacoma Park, is an amazing storyteller. And I was doing a story on the history of the Ward 4 area, which I don't know if you guys are also Ward 4, but...
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
So... right by where we live, where Walter Reed is, the old military hospital that has since been shut down, that was a very historically powerful area. They had the Battle of Fort Stevens there, which was the one battle in the Civil War that was fought here in Washington, D.C., also considered a turning point, although many of the wars were considered turning points. But the Union Army stopped the Confederate Army from taking the city, and it happened right there, right? And I was going to do some storytelling, and I was trying to actually connect people to place. And she said, come meet me at National Battlefield Cemetery. I said, well, where's that? She's like, you drive by it every day. And I was like, what do you mean? And she says, you know that little cottage that's right by the Walmart on Georgia Avenue that you always kind of see and probably looks a little strange, right by the Section 8 housing? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, come here. So she had me meet there on Sunday. And every Sunday, Cara Olivia goes to National Battlefield Cemetery because who was buried there are the soldiers that died protecting this city from the Confederate Army and essentially giving freedom to people. And they're all actually buried there. And nobody ever sees it, right? And Cara Olivia is like one of those people that are often in threat of being gentrified. And she holds the knowledge of that place. Like, it actually has direct meaning to her. And so I think about that a lot in our own city, actually, like the places that have meaning to people, right? Once we take the people away from the place, it loses its stories.
And it just loses, it doesn't exist anymore, yeah.
Which goes back to, I mean, you focus on, quote-unquote, the other, and when I think about the other, I think about what's happening with social media and globalization and how affluent young people live in the cities mm-hmm. and poor, marginalized people live in the country, and how we have more in common with an urbanite in Johannesburg than what mm-hmm. we have with somebody in West Virginia who mm-hmm. is 2 hours away mm-hmm. from us. And that seems to be the other nowadays, mm-hmm. you know, is the person who is really next to us but has nothing to do with who we are. Mm-hmm. And so can you comment on that? And do you see that? Because that speaks to your work.
Well, that goes everywhere, right? And if we're talking about the current political situation in America or any of that, what we tend to lose, I feel like, I've been thinking actually a lot about this in the last week because I was listening to a Dharma talk from somebody talking about bullying, actually. And he said, why is bullying so tough? Why is it so tough to look a bully in the eye? It's because it's the abuse of our primary form of connection, which is the reciprocal gaze. So going back to a lot of what you talk about with child rearing, both of you guys, that's our primary pattern of engagement, right? Before we know words or anything, right? With my little 3-week-old, he looks me in the eye, you know? Like, even though he can only see shapes in black and white and color, the eye patterning is something he is deeply attuned to. So I was thinking about that notion of reciprocal gaze, and when I talk about other, and I think something I've been like trying to write about for a really long time, but never having quite the language for, is reciprocal gaze. And what my work is about is trying to get people to look at other people and actually like not look at them like, oh, how strange, but oh, they are me. I am them. There is no difference between the two of us. And so that can be out on Tangier Island in the Chesapeake Bay. That can be in West Virginia. You know, I'm often I get sent a lot by Washingtonian or like different people that are always like, we're going to send Josh to the place that like we don't feel like we can send other people into. Like, he'll be okay there. But it is that reciprocal gaze, right? And we can talk about capitalism, its form, where we live in these affluent communities and the shadows of our own culture are pushed out to the edge, right? We don't see the consequences of consumption. We don't see the consequences of our actions because they're really out in that, they're just out of view. And even if they're right in front of us, our brains have a way, our bodies feel it, but our brains have a way of shutting it out of the woman that might be cleaning the lobby in our apartment building or something like that, right? Or even when we kind of walk down the street and we see somebody that is suffering in a way or asking for money, there's a way we don't want to, like, we stiff arm it intellectually. And it's the denial, you know, it's the denial of, like, the parts of ourselves. And again, this kind of goes back to our own humanity. So I've been thinking about it a lot, and like, in a more like, this is a little bit of a more of a lighthearted analogy, but you're in traffic, right? And this guy, he like wants to merge into your lane the last minute, dude. Cut all the way around you. You'd been waiting patiently in line.
That's
like,
Rob.
He does that.
But we've all been that guy.
Because that is me. Sometimes I let those people in. The reciprocal.
I am not a Buddha. I do that all the time. But
South America style.
But it's like. What is our behavior when somebody wants to do that? They're there. They're like leaning in our lane. They're like, hey, man. You're like, I'm not looking at that dude. I am not looking at that dude. I am
That's
not going to look at that dude. I'm not going to let that dude. And he's like, come on. And you look over him. You let him in. If you don't let him over, he's not human. You know, if you don't look at him, he's not human to you.
Of course. Right? It's whatever you
He's just this object, right?
Awareness.
Right. And so that's what I think this, like, that reciprocal gaze is this thing, right? So that's the thing that storytelling gives us a chance to do.
And I wonder, you know, the whole... It's like there's with so many people now, the density on this planet, and especially getting into like the urban centers, as far as how busy and full one's life is, it really becomes difficult to have
to be open and
to be open to everybody that crosses your path and know their story and see them as human and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, man, there's a, you know, we swim in against the current and a lot of this stuff of just to get back to the basics because of the situation of the density and the technology now. It's it ain't easy.
No,
you know,
it's not. And like none of this that I'm saying comes with any like you need to be more conscious, like because like
we're all
it's really
flopping
hard
on the seamy side, trying not to so much,
yeah.
You know. By not letting that guy in at the last minute, which I do sometimes and I don't the other.
Totally.
Oh. We're going to take a break, guys, okay? We're talking to Josh Coggan. He's an Emmy Award-winning photographer and anthropologist, and we'll be right back.
The music we're listening to is by Flash Frequency. It's called Oscillation. Local producer. We'll be right back on the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience.
Full Service Radio. Welcome back to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience on Full Service Radio. We are live from the Lang Hotel, and we are today with Josh Coggan. Josh is an Emmy Award-winning photographer and anthropologist, and we are talking about his career. And I want to go back to the Travel Channel. You were working with Anthony Bourdain, and you said that was the first time that you connected with people who... We're like you, fellow hardcore travelers who live for the experience. Of course, we, as everyone else on the planet, are extremely saddened by his death. So how was Anthony Bourdain and how was working with him?
Tony was a sweet guy. And like, you know, I had a very limited time knowing him, right? But they were intense, right? It's like when you travel with somebody, it's pretty intense. But I remember I was working at Travel Channel. Of all the hosts, like, I think actually I got my job at Travel Channel because the first thing they ever sent me to do was to photograph him in New York. And everyone was just terrified of Tony, right? Everyone was like, oh, man, he's like, he doesn't like a lot of people and he's, you know, this way or that way. And like, just don't piss him off because he's our biggest star, you know? And I was like, honestly, I'd never heard of Tony before that.
That's a good,
which was really helpful, right? Yeah. I was like, okay, like, I guess this guy's really difficult, but it can't be that difficult, right? So we get up to New York, we're shooting them. And, you know, I just remember like sitting there shooting them and I was the still guy in a video set, which was often the case. I was always the still photographer on the video set. And I remember one of the other PAs said to him, he was smoking a cigarette, and he was like, hey, Tony, you ever think about stopping smoking cigarettes? And he was like, man, I quit smoking crack. I can have my cigarettes. You know, I quit smack heroin. He had a bad run with heroin for a while. And he kind of said that, and they just went back to smoking a cigarette, you know? And it was like, basically, like, don't talk to me like that. Like, you're not, like... Talk to me like a person.
What the fuck do we know?
You don't know anything about my experience. And they were like, you know, I got back and I guess he had a good time. It was reported that I had done okay. And then like that got me in there. Like, well, we can set him up with Tony. We can set him up. But anyway, so they sent me out with a bunch of other people. But like Tony was always the more challenging set. Mostly his production company didn't want still guys on set. They were in a really quiet set, which is a lot of that came through in the authenticity of the show. Meaning that they're just... It was just allowing Tony to be with people, right? A lot of the other shows were very overproduced and like staged and scripted.
He did one take. Nothing else. Yeah. Whatever was coming naturally in the moment. And that was it.
And I went with Tony like to the Ozarks, Missouri, and I went to Brazil, and I'd been with him in New York, and I'd been with him in all these kind of different places. And like, and... You know, I actually didn't shoot him for many years after I did that first shoot, mostly because his production company didn't like doing stills, and they finally let me on the set for one. I think it was Brazil was the second time I shot him, and we were kind of there, and I was a little bit older at this point, and a little, like, probably a little less, like, easily shaken, and we started talking, and I realized really quickly he wanted to talk about psychedelics and heartbreak, which are, like, things that, you know, the three of us share in common and love to talk about. And I love to talk about being like, don't, you know, don't treat me with kid gloves. Talk to me like a being. Like, I want to drop in with you. And I realized that's why I say he was one of us. You know, he just like, he was very, very real. You know, I think we had a conversation, Rob, that stuck in my head. And he said he was a warrior. He was a warrior. You know, he didn't think of himself in any special way. And that showed up, you know.
Yeah, he was one of those that I never met him like you did, but just that seemed to be like one of us that kind of said, fuck that way that's prescribed or given. I'm going to go find my own way through it. And kind of he was definitely that, you know, and everything that he did.
He was very anthropological in the way that told his story. So I'm sure you can relate to that. And he basically found a new way of telling stories, which is another one of your big themes in your life.
He was a great storyteller. That's an amazing storyteller.
I want to go back again to the early 2000s, and you started doing interactive stories and new way of telling stories. And after all the struggle and all the hustle, you won an Emmy because your photographs were part of the Live Hope Love multimedia website for a story covering HIV in Jamaica. And what I really like about the way that you cover that story is that the images are very positive. So can you tell us a little bit about that experience? And what the Emmy meant in your career, that moment in time.
So the story had been funded by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, which is kind of a big grant-giving organization based out of here in D.C. And they were still pretty young now. They're a very kind of big and well-known organization now, but they were just starting out. And they had reached out to – I actually kind of got in through the back door a little bit because they had reached out to my friend Josh Goldblum, who's running this interactive company called Blue Cadet. And this was in the early days of like kind of digital online storytelling, and we had done a couple of projects together prior to that. Not a lot of people were in the field at that time, which like helped, you know. Everyone's in multimedia now. There were maybe a handful of people at that point, and they'd reached out to Josh, and we went in for a meeting. Josh was like, I want you to come to this meeting with the poet. So it was a poet. It was basically a combination of still photography and poetry. They're like, we want you to meet Kwame Dawes, who was the poet. Kwame's an incredible poet and has spent a lot of time down in Jamaica. And we were sitting in the office with him, a long table, and Kwame is like, listen, you know, it's really important to me that we're not pitting these people as we're telling them the story. You know, HIV is a very difficult disease to begin with. It's even more so difficult in Jamaica because it's a highly stigmatized disease. Homosexuality is very stigmatized. And some of our subjects are homosexual, some of them are straight. There's a real kind of like binary nature of Jamaica where it's a highly sexualized culture, and it's also like repressed and very religious in a lot of ways, which can lead to the rampant spread of a disease like this. And we were working with people in very poor communities, Spanish Town and St. Diego, some of these areas that were kind of near Trench Town and these areas. You know, he's like, it's really important to me that, like, there's not kind of an energy of pitying. I was like, Kwame, like, that's, I started showing my work, and I was like, listen, people are heroes. You know, again, it's like falling in love with people. It's like, people are heroes. And I've done a lot of work in kind of global disease and infectious disease, and it's always that, right? That's, if you're carrying any other energy in there, it's really, you can't even be with it yourself, you know? Because then you're just kind of jumping in. And the beauty of that story was you had Kwame's poetry, which was just lyrical, and did the same thing, right? I mean, I had a narrative. Usually I have to come down and make my own narrative. I had Kwame's narrative, this beautiful, beautiful poetry. At some point, I'll share with you. Well, you can hear on the
I've
site.
I've seen it. It's very powerful. I love it.
So you have that, and you get to shoot with that. And poetry, you know, is like poetry is to prose as photography is to video. You know, it's these like small little slices. And then when we, you know, we got back, we told the story. You know, there is like a little bit of a functional problem in the field of journalism where we love to celebrate ourselves instead of the people that are in the stories. But it did lead to us winning this Emmy, which was humbling and really cool and an experience, right? Like, again, I think that these awards are misapplied often. You know, we love to celebrate ourselves in these fields, but to win was, again, like one of those things like, okay, like I'm all right at this thing. You know, it's like one of those moments when the editor called me to her office, right? He's like, you often don't get a lot of confirmation. You're just kind of floating in the ether, just doing what you're doing because you love it. You know, artists do what they do because they love it. They don't really have a choice. And when somebody kind of sees you, it can be powerful, right? You're like, okay, like, all right. Like, it's serving a purpose. Like, I won't get overindulgent in thinking what that purpose is, but...
It's like the stamps of validity.
Yeah.
Kind of like a outside confirmation that what you're doing and how you're doing is your
well
own track.
Well-received.
Yeah. Which is important.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I try to be independent 100% of the outside and the input coming in from the out, it's still something that I still need.
And it opens doors.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
definitely.
Like the hustle we're all in is like, it opens doors. They're like, oh, Emmy, okay. Like, we know. It's like one of those things that grandma knows what it is, you know.
100%. Yeah, for sure. Bobby, I'm sure,
Bobby was proud of you.
To get that award, are those awards, was that something that you saw very easily, like that led to other opportunities, like before and after?
Totally. You know, the biggest thing that meant to me, and this is probably not actually what you're asking, but my mom and my dad, they were divorced when I was very young. They both came to the thing, and I remember, like, they called our name. And my dad, I have actually the video because I had him hold the camera. He's like, I don't fucking believe it.
I was very positive.
Yeah. Well, that's the first, right? That well, we go back to modeling, right? The first approval is from our parents. And then the approval from the outside comes from that.
But I have this photo with him outside, with me, with the award, and both of them there. And I was like, that's confirmation they didn't totally screw me up. For them. You know, like
they did a good job. You know,
they carried a lot of that around, right? It's like divorcing with a kid is tough. And then you saw it open up things, yeah, especially in a small town like D.C.
Right.
You know, never maybe on like a bigger stage. I think if I had really tried to pump that, it wasn't really my agenda, but D.C. it certainly helped. Like, people would write you back in an email. You know, I remember I'd written so many editors a gazillion times to like never get a response. And they're like, oh, yeah, you know, so...
We're talking to Josh Cogan. He is an Emmy Award winning photographer and anthropologist.
Well, I mean, you know,
and you're like listening to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience, and now you can talk, Rob.
No, I was saying that's something also with now with access to everybody. I mean, those are things that you use kind of to filter out, because now it's almost like American Idol. If you ever watch like the rehearsals, like it's a lot of people come on there and they're terrible, but they believe that they're amazing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like if someone comes and pitches themselves like the best, you kind of need to, okay, there's a lot of people that think they got the good shit.
Yeah.
Who really, truly has the good shit here? Yeah. And that's always something that, and everything is kind of like you have to do your homework and filtering out the really, who are you going to spend your time and energy with when it's so limited, you know? So maybe that on your signature that you're an Emmy Award winner helps that process.
I keep it at my parents' house.
Good place.
So, Josh, you have a lot of followers on Instagram. Mm. You have a one continuous running photo journal with beautiful images and long captions contextualizing the story. So what's your take on how Instagram has changed the way you share your voice and your images?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Social media is always a tough one. It's always a challenge, right? I like it because it gives me direct access. You know, increasingly, like, you know, and I'll say this now, the algorithms on Instagram and all these things have ruined it for a lot of people. I deeply believe that. Like, it's not really like, it's not a meritocracy so much as it's a likeitocracy.
If you're a celebrity or you have a cute puppy, you're going to get a lot of likes.
Yeah, or sadly enough, you know, and without going too deep down that rabbit hole, it still, like, is a platform where I can kind of think through things sometimes. I have to watch my engagement with it, you know. Sometimes I get really motivated to share on there, and sometimes I, like, struggle with it. I remember, you know, there was a period where I went through, which you guys know, about 4 years ago, went through a very difficult period. And in that choice, I didn't use Instagram for about maybe 3 months. I was like, I'm taking a sabbatical from everything. And Instagram reached out to me around that period, like about a month and a half in, and they were like, hey, we want to profile you, like, da 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 da, this will be really great for your followers. And I was like, wow, this is cool. I was like, yeah, I would love that. And then they wrote back and they're like, but we see you haven't posted in a month and a half, so we're not gonna do it on you, you know. And I was like, wow, like, there's no room for actually artistic process here,
I was 24/7,
like,
baby,
yeah, like, give it to
you, gotta
us,
always be available.
It's ratings, you know.
So I'm trying to find ways. I mean, I think Instagram has a beauty to it. It has an interactive, right? All things, right? We'll name this, and this is something we can share, the three of us, in conversation a lot, is like the beauty and the challenge of all things, right? I do think it's increased the ability of everyone to have a voice. It's become more difficult to have a voice, you know?
Of course. I see that.
And it makes me sometimes pull away, and then sometimes I lean in, you know? I get inspired and I get jealous. Right? Yep. Like, honestly.
What am I doing with my life?
Yeah, dude.
I'm not surfing down in Hawaii. And
it's really, dude, the Hawaiian surfer, the Kauai Instagrammers, they get you too? Is that the one you're talking about?
Oh, my God. And it reinforces, you know, there is a
wild
suspicion.
Wild schooling their kids, and I'm like,
Yeah. I mean, and also the saying of the grass is always greener. There's some, I wonder where that comes from. I mean, where there is this tendency to think that somebody has it better than you.
Yeah.
And then whenever you push into that, you realize that was an idea. But the social media definitely reinforces that.
Yeah.
That suspicion, you know?
Totally.
So it's like, that's something that I'm very aware of.
Totally.
I think I read something that you said, that you also like the idea of everyone having eyes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we always talk about Big Brother and how, you know, our information is available to everyone and they're spying on us and blah, blah, blah. And you have said that, you know, having the camera on your cell phone is sort of us watching back. Is that something that you really believe, that there's a power there?
Well, I think there is a power. I think that was in an interview like 3 or 4 years ago.
Your view has changed?
No. I mean, listen, I think here's what I can say is that if you look at almost all the major news stories outside of the grand political theater we're currently watching, outside of that, they're all driven by social media. Right? These existing things like Black Lives Matter, these these, well, that wasn't existing, but the big push that really brought down the mainframe,
like
was
Me
that people video recording these things, the body cameras on the police. You know, we're
Arab Spring,
watched.
The guy setting himself on fire in Tunisia started the whole Arab Spring pretty much and spread through Facebook, which that was fascinating when that happened.
Now we have the other side, you know, with people using fake accounts to convince us of things that don't exist.
Right.
And also the algorithm regurgitating, you know, your own beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And just
reinforcing
your own beliefs. So
I don't know if it's helping us. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's like such a challenging one. It can bring greater awareness if we want greater awareness. Most of us don't want greater awareness. We don't want it internally and we don't want it externally.
You know, I think it's impossible to... it depends on from what perspective you look at it. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to tell being inside of it if it's really helping us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Scale back out. And it's like, because it is happening, of course it's helping us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that thing as far as like, because things that happen at this scale, what is the digital technology, then the internet and social media, that's forever changing human to be what it means to be human.
Yeah.
Just like what it was when we started speech 40, 50,000 years ago, that there was no turning back because that was a new form of communication. And this seems to be that same thing. And being in the middle of it, there's like a lot of disruption and changing and things that were never will be again. So it's kind of like from the human perspective, it's a bit overwhelming because you see a lot of negative. Obviously, that is reinforced by media that tends to focus on that because you get higher ratings.
Mm.
But it's really it's hard to sift it out as far as the benefits, the positives, the negatives of this of social media and internet and connected to everybody at all times on the planet.
And there's this balance of like, this is what I'm trying to work with nowadays, of like so many of the injustices that people experience on a daily basis go unseen. You know, we talk about the reciprocal gaze, right? Without even kind of going into the list of them.
While we watch the Hawaiian surfers.
While we watch the Hawaiian surfers, exactly.
And think that they have it better than us.
And I want to
And we
think,
are privileged ourselves.
Yeah.
And we don't even
so
realize
much.
That.
Yeah, and then the layers that we're even talking about privilege, we're talking about the umpteenth of the umpteenth of the umpteenth of percent of what people experience, you know? And I want to actually really believe that this is the painful expansion of human cognition, right? It can be really difficult to war, right? When we go into that process internally of like seeing our own shadows and seeing the areas that we've disowned as a culture, that maybe that it feels like a lot of fighting right now, and it feels like you go on social media and everybody's arguing. Well, that's what's going on internally with ourselves too, right? And so we have to be brave and kind of go into that. And also try to maintain compassion as part of the process, right? Because we get very stuck in our own badness when we see those things, or we become aware of something. Maybe a not known. The first response is denial.
Yeah.
And now maybe acceptance.
Yeah.
I like that. Hey, I want to ask you about some of your most iconic pictures. If maybe iconic is not the word, but you seem to always somehow squirm your way into situations. And for example, during the Obama inauguration, that you weren't allowed to shoot there, and you ended up getting this amazing picture of JC and P. Diddy. So tell me about that.
I love that photo. So
it's an amazing photo.
Story was I'd been hired by Gibson Guitar because they were getting a guitar sign. They had this thing where they're like, take a guitar and have all the celebrities sign it, and then they'll auction it off for USO or something like that. And they need somebody to photograph the guitar, so they say, all right, this isn't a fake signature, right? This is literally it. And we were supposed to be like staying at this little table in like the hallway to the backstage. And they're like, don't move, just stand here. So, you know, all the,
where was this?
This was
the Howard
Warner Theater.
Wonder.
Yeah.
Okay, so this.
Yeah, the Warner Theater.
Uh huh.
And so, like, everyone's walking by. It's cool. Like, he walks by. Bam,
and Obama was
away.
There. They were celebrating.
I don't know if Obama was there, but it was the night before the inauguration.
Okay.
And we're sitting there, and then all of a sudden the show starts, and everybody leaves the back of the house. Like, everybody. Like, all the security guards that were like, stay there. My handler, like, the person, everyone's gone. I'm just, like, sitting there. And I was like, well, it's see where we can go. You know? So I literally go on the side stage door, and there's Diddy, and who was it? Memphis Bleek was there. He was like one of the guys at the time. And, you know, just kind of a lot of A-list, a lot of B-list. And it was, just, you know, just kind of a sweet night. Also, there's a really celebratory energy, right? Like, this is the first night Obama's about to be inaugurated. Like, you can't even, like, nobody can even believe what's happening. And I'm there, and then, like, I think, I'm trying to remember the story, but, like, you know, it was Jay-Z was running those shows where you would have a lot, Mary J. would come out, all these people, they would come out, kind of, like, do a little, like, a couple of songs, and then come back out. And at some point, like, Diddy's there the whole time. There's a funnier story about Punking Dave. We won't get into that. But Diddy's there. And, like, all of a sudden, Jay comes back. And he throws his arm around him. And you can just see this look, right? This look like, this is really happening. You know, despite all, like, I'm Jay-Z or P. Diddy, you know, the biggest names in the world, like,
we have a black dude little brother in the White House.
Yeah, like, little brother, this is happening, right? And you can actually see real humility, right? You don't really associate Diddy and these guys with humility. You can see this, like, wonder, right? Wonder is, like, the antithesis of ego. And, like, you can see these guys just, it's, like, beautiful. It's just, like, this really sweet moment.
I wonder if you could photograph them right now embracing.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
see what that expression would be in yeah. this moment in time.
Yeah. Yeah.
8 years
it would be very different.
Yeah.
Very different time. Hey, so I can't let you go without talking about, you know, psychedelics and mm-hmm. living off the grid.
These were good. These finally,
are,
man.
These let's are the juicy
stuff. Let's get to the juicy stuff. What is this?
You and Rob have had this ongoing conversation for over a decade.
Uh-huh.
And you've also built your life around mm-hmm. building community, and mm-hmm. you created the Sweet Magnolia Farm, mm-hmm. Which is your house, but it's also a community space in Washington, D.C. So, mm-hmm. so let's just, you know, free flow.
Yeah, you know, the last
before show, we let you go.
Me and Rob go cosmic. All right, yeah, so we have 3 minutes. Yeah. Because you're in a cosmic in 67. I mean,
you got anything to go to, Jack? We need to get off in 3 minutes. If so, we should just wrap it up.
No, just start.
You know, because Mateo was here the last show, right. Which, you know, and mm-hmm. he's gone out to California now. He went all on his experiences with mm-hmm. with ayahuasca mm-hmm. and kind of like the experience of what that meant to him. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's something that we've talked about a lot. And you had an experience.
You've been going
with
to Burning
him.
Man, and
yeah. Well, I mean, psychedelics have always been a very healing agent for me from my very young ages. Probably college was the first time I'd experienced them. I found that at different periods of my life, I've had different relationships with them. I think that the renaissance that we're seeing right now is an incredible thing, and you know, that's it's a big topic. I mean, I think. Here's what I'll name is that much of the community, some of the seeds of the community that I have built around the house at Sweet Magnolia Farms have come from the burner community. They've come from farming communities. They've come from mindfulness communities. They've come from DC-based creative communities and artist communities. And the reason the house is the way it is, the reason that it's developed in the way it is because I think there's very few models. You know, this is, it has become the only authentic answer I have to everything that's happening in the culture right now, which is decommodification. That's one of the principles of Burning Man. And so at the house, we have these beautiful concerts. We'll have, like, you know, I have a nice relationship with Bob Boylan at Tiny Desk. He has kindly, like, sent some bands my way, just incredible bands that you would have to go see at pretty big clubs, and they'll come play at the farm because of the energy of the place.
Yeah. Which the farm, guys, is in the middle of Washington, D.C.
It's a farm in Washington, D.C.
Five blocks from our house. It's not a farm, but it operates as a farm.
Yeah.
As a community space.
And a massive magnolia tree with a garden and a big deck / stage.
And if you can grow your own food, that's one of the first areas of, like, decommodification, right? That's actually one of the, like, our primary rights that we, like, kind of lost as people.
We were just listening to a podcast about what are they called? The Earth houses?
Earthships.
The Earthships. Yeah. And how if we can generate our own electricity and our own water, we are not dependent on this.
It's a level of freedom that you have as opposed to being so dependent.
So we have rainwater collection.
The guy
systems,
was going wild, and he was like, we wouldn't have ISIS, we wouldn't have this, we wouldn't have that if people would have the basics.
Because if you had everybody on the planet that had food, shelter, and their basic needs covered, then they wouldn't be so willing to go out and kill themselves to do damage.
And the deeper message is what I'm trying to get over here in D.C., which we have a lot of worth wounding in D.C. and in urban areas. And I call worth wounding of like, I have to be something to be seen or worthy or important.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
It's like this messiah complex.
And like the whole farm situation is supposed to be like, you don't have to be anything to be here. We just ask for your participation. Come grill. Come, you know, every year we do a big spring dig. People come and plant, you know. They can come play music. And, like, I think it's one of the few spaces, and I think because there's not a, you know, I mean, there's, like, you know, a cost of maintaining it and this and that. But because people, it's a decommodified space, people want to care for it. They actually want to put in their time. You know, I'm having people over all the time. They wash their own dishes. They clean up. They do all these things. They bring food. It ends up actually being this, like, self-running situation, and without that, there's something that's filling to them as people, you know.
You know, I sit here wondering. I wonder, like, now that you're a father as of 3 weeks ago, I wonder how that will change. Not, I mean, you know, just how will it evolve? Because also
takes a village.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it takes a village, but also I just know that there is a little more now maybe than I was before, a little more insular with protecting my inner tribe kind of thing. So I wonder what the next chapter of, like, Magnolia Farm will be.
Well, we've already had a bunch of music nights. You know, and the thing is, you know, I thought about that too, and I realized that, you know, my friend Matt McEntee, and he came over the night. He's like, I'm here to vine up your tomatoes. You know, I didn't ask him to come over and help. He just brought a bunch of bamboo. He started trellising everything. You know, Matt knows incredible amounts of woodwork. I think about my friend Lauren, you met at the Birthing Circle, plays banjo. She's coming over and writing songs for my aunt already. Like, aunties and uncles, you know, I'm very finite as a being. Like, I'm gonna fail in a lot of ways as a father. You know, I'll bring some good things too, but like, together we can do it, you know. The village model is a way, you know, and I think we can do that in the city. I think that's what I'm always trying to bring back,
you know? yeah it's from having kids, how was it possible without it? Because of how much time it takes and attention to raise a children, if you're on your own, or even if it's just you and your mate. I mean,
otherwise they end up being a commodity, and you put them in daycare and go back to work.
Here's the bigger picture is, when you live in a place that doesn't allow time paid off, secures your position, that doesn't support families to have children, it's near impossible be able to do it. And just to have the
therefore
focus
the importance
and priority
of having your independence.
Right. Yeah. You build if the greater structure is not going to support it, then build your own little subset of that structure that will support
which is
it.
What you're doing.
Yeah.
And to find people with the values. I mean, you guys were one of the first people I met in DC who were like, we get it. You know? Like, sometimes you feel like you have to scream a little bit in DC, but don't you see?
Yeah. Yeah.
We get it, Josh. Thanks so much for being with us. We get it.
Yeah, get it. Got it. Get
you
it
guys got
all
it.
Day
long
long.
Time ago. You had to teach it back to me when I forgot it.
Oh, we teach each other all the time. It's back and
we
forth.
We forget it every day, and then we say, second. "I'm sorry."
Yeah, keep going. Totally.
Yeah. Totally. Love you.
Love you guys. Yeah. So
thank you very much.
You.
Thanks for coming to the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. See you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio.
Thanks for listening.